This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome to Medicine on Call. Last week we had, I think, a very enlightening conversation about the House resolution, or I guess it's a law now, about the SGR and about how it changed from they so-called fixed the doc fix and made it value-based in terms of payment for Medicare. And it's such a complex topic that I wanted to revisit it, and I wanted to get an expert to come on with me today, because this is not medicine anymore. We're talking about law. And Dr. Marilyn Singleton is somebody who I highly respect and I love having on my show, because not only is she a doctor, but she's also a lawyer. And she spends a lot of time that most of us don't have, and she actually understands what she reads, like most of us don't, these laws that have been, or bills, legislation, everything that's been coming left and right at us, full scale, to try to destroy the independent medical physician and, I think, healthcare in general. So, Dr. Singleton, I want to thank you so much for coming on today, because I wanted to get your take and have you tease out exactly what's going on.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on your show, Dr. George. I do love being here. I just always hate what we have to talk about.
I know, it's depressing.
Well, it is distressing. And we went to medical school to be doctors and take care of patients and not to have to worry about all this nonsense, but here it is.
Mm-hmm.
This SGR, as we'll call it, sustainable growth rate, that used to be how Medicare paid doctors, and it was supposed to be tagged to the economic index. And then, interestingly, the cost of health care went up faster than the economic index, so then actually doctors were being paid less than their office costs to see the patients. So Congress kept on stalling the SGR payment, knowing that doctors would be underpaid and possibly stop taking Medicare patients. And we all know Medicare is the holy grail of medicine. And so Congress got together, both sides, and came up with this so-called doc fix. And it was very clear when you start reading it that the first 10 pages of a 260-page bill look really good. It's like, whoa, we won't have the doc fix anymore. And everyone threw up their hands and started to cheer, put the bill down, and didn't read the rest of it. Well, the rest of it, in the end, I honestly believe will be very anti-patient and will make it so doctors will not want to take care of sick patients. And the reason I say this is they've moved to a payment system where a doctor can opt in to one of two systems. One, join a so-called ACO, an accountable care organization, which is, in other words, be employed by the hospital and be in a great big group that the hospital controls. Or two, join a merit-based incentive program where there's multiple rules and paperwork that you have to fill out, a list of 300-some-odd quality measures that you have to fill out. And the problem with these are, they're things like the blood sugars in a diabetic, how well a heart failure patient is doing, how well your cigarette-smoking lung disease patient is doing. Well, that's all well and good that you're prescribing the right medications and whatnot. But the one factor that's left out, of course, is the patient complying with all those medicines? Mm-hmm. So let's say you tell your heavy smoker to cut back on the smoking, even quit, give him patches, whatever, give him e-cigarettes, whatever you can do, and the patient doesn't comply. So he comes to the office the next time, and his numbers, his metrics, aren't any better. The doctor will then be penalized in his Medicare payment.
So it's, when they say value-based, it's really not anything really to do with what's going on clinically in a deep sense. It's just how it looks on paper, algorithms.
Exactly. And the measures, they're unbelievable. When you first look at them, you think, okay, well, yeah, we'll follow blood sugars or follow an EKG, whatever, and each specialty has its own set of measures.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know medicine is more complex than that. There's people who might have good numbers, but they look like the Dickens when they walk in your office.
Right.
And vice versa.
Exactly. It's an art. It's not just a science. And we say that a lot on the show. And you can't expect, just because you give somebody a medication, for them to respond the same way as another patient. It just doesn't work that way.
That's right. And not to mention, when you combine this with various other changes, where so many of these medication formularies have been reduced down and stripped down to the bare minimum, that you may have a patient, well, you're ENT, you know, look at the difference in thyroid medications.
True.
And if the formulary says, well, now we're only going to use X, your patient might not do as well. And they'll either have to go out and buy that medication with their own money, which they shouldn't have to if they've paid for insurance that presumably should be paying for medications. But the government has decided that, no, we will only pay for X brand. And as doctors, we know that, yes, 90% of the time, the generic's going to work. But there is 10% of people that really do need a specific brand.
And they're out of luck into this system.
That's right. That's right. But then, of course, not only does the patient remain sick, the doctor then gets penalized for it. But it's only the fault of the regulation and not because the doctor wasn't trying to be a good doctor.
I mean, it comes down to personal responsibility. That's completely removed from this system.
And absolutely.
And that's
the scary part.
Very much so, because that's the underpinning of the doctor-patient relationship. You know, when you have that camaraderie between a doctor and the patient, and you make a recommendation, you expect the patient, if they understand why they need to do something, that they'll do it. And now you're really under duress. I think the average doctor, or the average person, if you're in a system where you're always going to be blamed for something that's not going right, you're going to start to, your behavior will start to change. You'll stop taking so many of those patients into your practice, maybe.
See, and this is what is scary to me, because already the way the Affordable Care Act, it pains me to even call it that, is set up, that you can see that the insurers would love to shun sick people. And, of course, people with pre-existing conditions are now lumped in. Of course, nobody told anybody how much extra they'd have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thought, oh, well, how great. We can just jump in with everybody else. But that's not quite the case. It will definitely happen with Medicare, because there's the payment's low anyway. And why would somebody take on a patient who's very sick, has multiple problems, and particularly if they've had the patient and in the past the patient has shown themselves to be difficult to manage as far as handling the medications, and then even personality-wise, the doctor will just say, gee, I'm sorry, I can't handle this case anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then where will that patient be shuttled? I just envision that there's going to be kind of a dumping ground for people like that.
I think there already is. I think it's hospice. You know, we're seeing a lot more a movement towards younger patients, towards non-life-threatening illnesses ending up in hospice. And for those folks out there who think the accountable care organizations are the end-all, be-all, remember the hospitals have a fiduciary responsibility, even though they're, quote, non-profit most of the time, to their shareholders to make money. And I've already seen this, you know, where they don't want to admit patients. They treat them, you know, by remote. You put them on online, and you watch them, you know, you monitor their blood sugars by the internet. Anything you can do not to admit patients all of a sudden is how it goes, because if you readmit someone within 30 days with the same diagnosis, you won't be paid. So the hospitals are figuring this out very quickly. Keep them in the satellite locations, in the accountable care pod, but don't admit them, because that's where they're going to lose the money.
That's right. That's right. So there you go. And patients don't realize it. They're finally getting wise to the scandal of the so-called two-midnight rule, where patients have to be actually admitted to the hospital for a nursing home care, rehab care, to be paid for by Medicare. And so even stroke patients, some heart attack patients, are kept in the emergency room for 3 days. Then that way, it's not logged on the hospital records as an admission. Well, the hospital doesn't tell the patient that this means no. In a patient's mind, if you're there for 3 days, of course you think you were admitted to the hospital. But, oh, no, technically you're not admitted. So then they're sent to rehab, and they get a huge bill for $300 a day for all this time they spent there in rehab and wonder why, since they read their Medicare thing that said that Medicare pays for post-hospitalization for a month. Because they were never admitted to the hospital.
And I want to go into a little bit more detail on that. Just people need to know that Medicare changed the designation of admission. And you're right. You would think if you go into the hospital and you get a bed that you're admitted as an inpatient. But they now have three designations, or maybe there's four: ambulatory, outpatient, observation, and inpatient. And if your doctor doesn't code the right diagnosis, admission form, or admission, or I should say admission, if they don't put you in the right track of admission, like you admitting as an observation, as instead of an inpatient, which is really arbitrary, you basically have to be, you can be really sick like you described, but not meet all the criteria to become an inpatient. And you're right, you will not be eligible for rehab. And they don't tell patients this. And the bill drops to the patient and the patient's family. So you think you're covered under Medicare, but they've got all sorts of games that they'll play with you, and you'll find out behind, you know, after the fact, that you're not covered, which is must be devastating financially, emotionally. You're already sick, and then you get stuck with a, you know, couple hundred thousand dollars, or at least a couple thousand dollars when you come out of the hospital. It's tragic.
Absolutely, and a person might have made other arrangements had they known.
Exactly.
And interestingly, one of the bills that some of the Congress people have put out, and there's one in the Senate and one in the House, is to have to give patients large print written notice about this.
I wonder how long is it, though? Is it like 10 pages so the patient can't understand it?
You know, interestingly, with so many of these laws, and these are things that a lot of people just don't get when a law starts to be put into action, and they think, gee, this is so different from what they told us, that the law many times is a kind of a semi-bare bones where it says you are going to do this, 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 and they change some language in a law that's already been written. It's the regulations that define out all the day-to-day details, and that's what's not in the law. And this is what we're hearing so much on the news about how Obama changed immigration just on his own and all that, or the various EPA regulations that just seem to pop out of nowhere. And this is taking a sentence out of a law and then adding 10 more sentences to it via the regulations. And generally speaking, there's five times as many pages of regulations as there is the law. So you can imagine what they can do to a law as it's written. So the law says a patient has to have notice, and it doesn't say that it has to be one page and 16-point type or anything like that. The regulation will spell that out. Well, depending on who's writing it and who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services and what their political bent is, the notice could be small, it could be large, it could be, like you say, 20 pages long. So somebody who's just strolled in with a stroke certainly isn't going to be able to read it, much more understand it.
Absolutely not. On that note, let's take a break and come back. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree ENT Center. Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you've probably noticed that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you were able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will continue to rise while your healthcare choice and access will continue to fall. The good news is Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We are committed to working with you. We specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductibles or catastrophic coverage. And we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And Dr. Singleton, before the break, you mentioned regulations and how they're crafted. I'm a layperson here. Who are these people who write the regulations? I mean, if Congress is not, you know, they're sitting here, I assume, crafting a bill, crafting legislation, and they're all in on it from the time they think it up and to the time that it's presented for debate, etc. What's going on? Who's the issue? Who's writing the regulations? I understand that Health and Human Services, that secretary, has total global power. They're a czar, basically, over the Affordable Care Act. But this happens throughout Congress. Every time a bill passes, everything that's ever done, you're right, EPA, whatever, the regulations are so disgusting and onerous, and it seems to me very political. Am I right that it's a political exercise, and who are these people, this committee that does this?
Well, number one, you began with saying Congress writes these laws.
Yeah.
One thing we have to know is that it's the congressperson's staffer who writes it, or the lobbyist's law firm who writes it. And it's certainly not the congressperson. Every now and then they might. But generally speaking, I mean, it's talk about getting into a whole nother conversation, is when you basically have the lobby of whomever is in the congressperson's pocket, that's who writes the law. So once we get the law out there, then, as you said, Secretary of Health and Human Services then has total control. I mean, it was sort of one of the things that people kept on pointing out with the Affordable Care Act, that multiple times at the end of some paragraph, it would have, and the secretary shall, blah, blah, blah. And so then it became completely up to Health and Human Services Secretary to write the regulations. The problem is that somebody might say, well, if you have another president in, then they're going to appoint a new secretary and they can rewrite them.
Mm-hmm.
This never happens. These regulations are so voluminous that, I mean, they take up shelves. It's unbelievable when you see the regulations, especially for the section of the U.S. Code that contains Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. They're just huge.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's going to change them. So they become kind of set in stone, and then the next person kind of does some add-ons or some workarounds, but nobody does a clean sweep of this stack of regulations. And in fact, half the time, they don't even know what's in the regulations. I will tell you one that shocks most people when they find out. This is, by regulation, not the Social Security and Medicare law themselves, that if a person decides they don't want Medicare Part A, let's say they're in a health services ministry, whatever, or maybe they just don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
If they decline Medicare Part A, they will lose their Social Security benefits. Not only do they lose future benefits, the government can come back and take all the benefits that they have given you.
So you have to pay them back?
They make you pay them back.
It's your money. You work for it.
Well, and the thing is, you might want to manage your own health care.
Exactly.
But feel like, you know what? For all these years, I paid 7% of my income into Social Security. I want it back.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't get it back. And it's one line, one sentence in the Medicare regulations. And this has actually been litigated, and the opinion's very interesting in that the judge says, while I don't agree with this and think this is totally silly, I am a judge and I have to follow the law, and she had to find against the plaintiffs who wanted to keep their own insurance. They had insurance from another source,
right,
even though they qualified for Medicare. And as long as people are working these days, this really should be decoupled, because there's a lot of people now who are working past 65
mm-hmm.
and would rather have the group plan from their employer as their primary insurance and not Medicare.
You know, you would think that common sense, if common sense ever ruled in the government, they'd be happy about this. They don't have enough money in Medicare to cover folks. They are rationing care. They should be happy that somebody who's already paid into the system doesn't want to access it. Wouldn't that be a benefit to the system?
Oh, but Dr. George, that is very commonsensical financially,
mm-hmm.
but that ignores the bigger picture. If you're out of the system, then you can't be controlled.
That's an excellent point. And I want to turn that around now. We know the patients are under duress and on the hook. What about the physicians? I've been preaching this for quite a while, that they want us to be dependent on a system. They want to control our pocketbooks. They want to control our intellectual capital. They want us to become agents of the government. Is that far-fetched? Have I been talking hyperbole, or is this really what's going on?
Oh, it's what's going on. And indeed, in this whole SGR payment system, one of the metrics is having your electronic medical records hooked up with HHS so they can get all your statistics, and there's certain demographics that have to be recorded in your electronic health record.
Mm-hmm.
And if they aren't there, then you get dinged. And they make up these quality components for your payment, some of which has nothing to do with good medical care, but it's just how they can keep tabs on everybody. Now, one might argue, okay, gee, this is great. Now we'll have some health statistics, and we'll know how society is doing health-wise, et cetera, et cetera. And sure, maybe we will. But on the other hand, that's too much information in the government's hands.
Absolutely. And the sad thing, too, it's just raw data. It's metadata. So it doesn't apply to real world. I mean, I used this example before. If you give a patient an antidepressant to help them stop smoking, all the government sees, or the HHS data bank sees, is that you're on an antidepressant. And so there must be something mentally wrong with you. Well, will they start tracking you if you ever start to, you know, get a government job? You want to buy a legal handgun? Whatever it is, they now have something on you that works against you. And it may not be the case. I mean, you know, you're going to get a diagnosis based on a medication that you've been prescribed ever in the history of that medical record going electronic. And it doesn't work that way medically most of the time.
Well, the worst, they already are doing that with narcotics mm-hmm. in many states, and there's yet another law that somebody has put forth. Well, it's now a bill that basically enhances the government knowledge of drug prescriptions. And this is all classes, the DEA classes drugs, 1 through 5, as far as the lower numbers are super, super narcotics, and mm-hmm. 5 are things that are practically over the counter. And if you have anything Schedule 2 and above, it has to go in a database. And like you, the example you gave, having an antidepressant for smoking, well, somebody might have had a narcotic because they had some injury,
mm-hmm.
and someone could decide that, well, this injury should be over by now. Well, some people heal more slowly than others. All these things aren't included in the database. They don't put the patient's whole history in there. Like you say, it's just marked down that they have this drug.
Yep. And then you also have to take into consideration there's humans involved with these electronic medical records. So people cut and paste. They write whatever. They put information to a wrong patient's chart, and they never notice it. And it ends up going following that patient forever, for the rest of their lives. You know, I mean, it's a bad system. It doesn't make it more efficient. I have never seen any doctor, including myself, who can say that I can finish my note faster or do a better job as opposed to just handwriting it. You know, and just makes everything longer.
Well,
the hospital's worse.
It does encourage cut and paste. And the cut and paste, as we all know, doesn't work too well, even in our own random Word documents when you double cut and do this and do that, or you leave the other name in, and all these things that happen with cut and paste, and just because you're under time pressure.
Well, it promotes mediocrity. It doesn't promote excellent patient care. You're spending all your time entering data to close the electronic medical record. And I've used an example, too, in the hospital especially. If you don't fill out every single section, you cannot close the chart. You cannot move on to the next patient. So they have some controls on you as a physician to make sure you dot every I, cross every T. And they want these things. This is not just arbitrary information. Like you said, I think they're creating a whole template or a whole they're mining data on everything about you, from your license plate that they read to your electronic medical record to your credit card purchases. They're getting a whole picture of you, what you possibly will do in the future. You know, it's crazy. I mean, it's dystopian. It's bigger than 1984.
Well, it is. And the sad part, it's a common tool. You do this to a subset of people where it's quite detailed, like it is with physicians.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not that many doctors. Most people have no idea what doctors do on a day-to-day basis. You know, they look at Grey's Anatomy or or they have their own interaction with the doctor, which all seems quite simple, and particularly if it's going to somebody's private office. If it's a larger thing, yes, there's more paperwork and whatnot. But you're sick, you get your surgery, and you go home, and then you're finished with the medical system. It's not your day-to-day life. So all these little details and things that are imposed upon doctors, people aren't going to think about. They think, okay, fine, well, doctors make money, they deserve to do that, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But you realize that that's a template for what will happen to you. It's almost as though testing out these sorts of dictates and controls on a smaller group are a way to see how well they work. How well do people comply? Do people stand up and say, no, this is hokum. I'm not going to do this. This is taking up all my time. And doctors have to stand up and say, yeah, this is taking up all my time. The one good thing is, because of some of this, more doctors are learning about how to opt out of Medicare.
Yeah, that's the best thing.
That's a good thing, because now patients realize that there is another path. Initially, I said they're giving you two paths to get payment. Well, that's the third path. Just don't be in the Medicare program at all.
On that note, let's take a break and explore that third path when we come back. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center. Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure? Do other people smell things that you don't? Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps, a chronic sinus infection, or allergies that are either undertreated or have never been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we use state-of-the-art equipment so you can see the problem. You'll be a partner in your care, and together we will decide the course of treatment, because we believe in old-fashioned medicine, where we take the time to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. We specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation sinus surgery, correction of a nasal septal deviation, and turbinate reduction surgery that can be done in the office, getting you back to work the next day. And you can rest assured that all options will be discussed before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. If you'd like to make an appointment, call 404-591-9100 or reach us on the web at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock for Medicine on Call. On Medicine on Call, we talk about more than medicine. It's about how to take control of your mind, body, and spirit. This is Dr. George from Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center. We've won patient care awards and have the highest patient recommendations because I believe in practicing medicine the old-fashioned way. Practicing good medicine is based in listening to the patient and making a care plan that's individualized. The best medical care is given when there is a strong doctor-patient relationship built on mutual trust and respect. At Peachtree ENT Center, we believe in taking care of the whole patient because healing is more than writing a prescription. Whether you have problems hearing or your child has frequent throat infections, from the time you call our office and speak to a real person, you'll be treated as an individual, not an ailment. During your visit, you'll not be rushed, and all of your questions will be answered. And when possible, I will recommend natural treatments to fix the problem. If surgery is recommended, cost-effective, minimally invasive treatment for snoring, sleep apnea, or sinus problems will be offered, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. If you'd like to make an appointment, call 404-591-9100 or reach us on the web at www.peachtreeentcenter.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Prior to the break, you were talking, Dr. Singleton, about how there's a third path. And I think for everything, not just medicine, I preach on this show, you just need to withdraw your consent. Stop just blindly following things that are hurting you. And that means stop shopping in the big box stores. Stop voluntarily buying things that are going to kill you. GMO, taking vaccines. And I mean, vaccines in a global sense, there's nothing wrong with them from a medical standpoint. It's what's in them and the fact that they're mandating them. This is where I have the biggest problem with this. This is like a medical tyranny at this point. As soon as your doctor loses their control, they're going to become the conduit to make you do stuff. Have you noticed the big push towards vaccines for everybody? I don't care if you're a child now, and now it's adults that seems to be coming online.
Well, you know, I'm here in California, where right now they are putting forth a bill, and it's being argued because it passed the health committee, that will eliminate the personal exemption from vaccines. They'll still have the religious, but the personal will be eliminated. And this certainly was brought out because of the Disneyland problem. That's where the measles started up again. And the fellow that put it forth is a pediatrician.
Of course.
So he's certainly not ignorant about medicine. And interestingly, the good thing about things like this, whether no matter what your opinion about mandatory vaccines is it drew the public out. There were huge town halls over this, more so than anything I've seen in a very, very long time. And interestingly, some of our wealthier counties are the ones where a lot of folks aren't vaccinating their children.
It's because they're reading.
So perhaps that's the help, that these were people of means and education who were affected, because so many times there was an article I wrote, oh, probably a year or so ago, one of the incidents of government doing things without our knowledge was where they tested out a new vaccine in Los Angeles. Who did they test it on? Poor blacks and Mexicans, because they didn't know to ask. Now, people weren't harmed by it, but the people never knew that it was an experimental drug. They just thought they were getting regular free vaccinations.
I'm having flashbacks of Tuskegee experiment, et cetera, on this stuff.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. And so if this is when you talk about how this mushrooms, at first people think, oh, golly, you know, are you going to see aliens landing in your backyard next? It's not far-fetched because it has actually happened. It's just that it hasn't happened to everyone, so people don't realize that your health is a way to get a lot of personal information, and something that information about your health is something that can be used against you and not by the insurance company.
Absolutely, and it can make you, put you in a position where you have to do things against your will. I mean,
yes,
this is an example. It sounds like a small deal, you know, it's just a vaccination. But it's about informed consent. As a physician and as an anesthesiologist, you can't take someone to surgery. You can't put them under anesthesia without informed consent. That is our ethical underpinning, moral medical underpinning, to explain risk and benefit. it gets completely stripped away when you mandate these things. If anybody bothers to read those inserts, it tells you that it's basically they don't know what can happen if you give it to a pregnant woman. They don't know what will happen if you give it to a child. And they're held blameless and harmless. And you're supposed to just say, okay, just stick me with as many things as you want to. I just have a problem with that. If the insert is telling you that it's unsure if it's safe, then the government cannot make you. But they shouldn't ethically or morally be able to make you do something that could potentially hurt you. And then on the flip side, I know you know about the fact that you have this immunity for these companies that if they do hurt somebody, they're off the hook. So they've spent a lot of time in the last 20 years making tons of vaccines, but it doesn't work like that for things like antibiotics, and you can barely find a new antibiotic on the market. The companies are going to do what they make the most money on, and they're in bed with the government, right?
Well, and it's also a tough call. It does take a lot of money to come up with a new drug, and when a lawyer pulls together one of these class action lawsuits over X, Y, or Z drug, that the drug company is going to be sorry they ever put it out in the first place. And it's a fine line between saying, okay, they're ripping us off because they came out with this new drug. Well, guess what? If it's a wonder drug and a miracle drug, people are more than happy to pay to have it. But if it then has a problem, well, all right, sue the bastards, you know. Mm-hmm. But then the next time I say, well, you know what, maybe we won't put all that money into it, that they'll look at something that just has a high rate of return and very low risk. I mean, and because these are things that come out all the time when with orphan drug laws and compassionate use laws where there's a drug that hasn't been approved yet, but somebody's dying and they say, hey, I don't care, I'm dying anyway, let me give it a try. So there is a range of not only science but emotions that goes into it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to use your child as a guinea pig, but if you're dying of cancer, you're more than happy to put yourself out as a guinea pig.
To me, that's appropriate. I understand that from a medical and an intellectual standpoint. But then you have this flip side where you have the ability for a company to, and they do these studies, they're all internal, they're all underwritten by the pharmaceutical company itself. There's no, you know, independent body looking at this. They jerry-rig their results. They've even said they've done it. And then they put these drugs on the market or these vaccines on the market or whatever it is, and then that's why you end up with these class action suits. Look at, what was that pain medicine? I forget what it's called now. But they knew there was a problem with it. They put it out, they made billions of dollars on it, and then it got recalled. So even though they get a little fine, it's nothing compared to the amount of money they made on the medication. And if the government's going to give something immunity, blanket immunity, and make the person who's injured fight tooth and nail just to get recompense, that's where I have an issue with that. I mean, recently in the UK, I think, I don't know if it's GlaxoSmithKline, I think it was them, they were sued by people who were injured by their vaccine there, and they had to pay out a money for it. That doesn't happen in the United States because it's immunity here. So,
well, you get money from the vaccine fund.
But they never pay it. It's very small.
But exactly. I mean, it's not a huge amount of money, but then part of it is, what do you do if the government has mandated that you take a vaccine? Mm-hmm. Basically, the government has taken control over the process. And that has to then relate back even to the manufacturing process in the sense, okay, FDA approved it, and that's where you start to get to the issue of, where's the FDA? Is it doing its job? It's supposed to be approving these things, and if all they're going to look at are internal studies, then the FDA isn't doing its job. That's what we have assumed. We, as citizens, have assumed that the FDA is screening these medications before they approve them.
Yeah, well, you have to note, too, that the FDA's upper echelon is like a revolving door between them and the drug companies. You know, they've
exactly.
Gone from,
well, it's like the SEC. The SEC is the training ground for people to then go and become an executive in a stock trading firm. And everybody kind of knows that. It's one of the reasons that a lot of firms aren't flagged for this, that, or the other, mm-hmm. because everybody knows everybody. It's just a very incestuous relationship. And as you say, the same thing goes on in the FDA. Well, this is sort of one of the reasons that, gee whiz, you put all your trust in this organization that was supposed to examine these drugs before they gave it the stamp of approval, mm-hmm. and then it turns out they didn't. And then you're the poor schnook who took the drug.
That's right, and you paid hand over fist for it on top of that. So, I mean, this is a big, huge system. This is, doctors are only the cog in the wheel. We're just supposed to just keep writing prescriptions to help this system run. But it's not about health. You know, it's gone well beyond actually taking care of somebody and getting them out of the system. It's about managing people and managing them in a way that keeps them in but makes them not too expensive at the same time. It's sick, isn't it?
Well, you think back to all these novels where everybody's given a drug that makes them compliant, and I think we've been given our regulatory drug, and you just do one more thing, and then pretty soon you don't realize that you're in lockstep where you could have said no at some point before, and then you're just so, oh well, it's just this, oh it's just this, oh it's just this. And the next thing you know, you've lost control.
That's exactly how they want it, I believe. On that note, let's take our last break. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree ENT Center. Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you've probably noticed that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you were able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will continue to rise while your healthcare choice and access will continue to fall. The good news is Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We are committed to working with you. We specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductibles or catastrophic coverage. And we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center. Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure? Do other people smell things that you don't? Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps, a chronic sinus infection, or allergies that are either undertreated or have never been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we use state-of-the-art equipment so you can see the problem. You'll be a partner in your care, and together we will decide the course of treatment, because we believe in old-fashioned medicine, where we take the time to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. We specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation sinus surgery, correction of a nasal septal deviation, and turbinate reduction surgery that can be done in the office, getting you back to work the next day. And you can rest assured that all options will be discussed before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. If you'd like to make an appointment, call 404-591-9100 or reach us on the web at www.peachtreeentcenter.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. I mean, I think we're getting to a little bit of into the deeper aspects of the system. And, you know, something at the beginning of our show, you talked about how legislation is written by aides and by lobbyists. Do you think that the average congressperson actually reads these bills, or they just give them a synopsis and they just go out there on the floor and hawk it? What do these people do all day? I'm just curious. I'm disgusted, honestly.
Schmooze,
huh? Have lunch. Okay.
Well, it's kind of funny because it sounds quite cynical, but in Sacramento, our state capital here, Sacramento isn't a well-to-do city by any stretch of the imagination, and there's sort of a refurbished part called Old Sacramento and, you know, sort of hokey Western kind of things there and whatnot. And then there's an area that's around the state capitol buildings. They have these restaurants where steaks are $50 and all this kind of stuff, and all these little tiny meeting rooms with booths in the basements of these restaurants, and it's kind of a joke that, well, these are where all the assemblymen and state senators are hanging out all day, and you go there in the afternoon and they're just filled with people in their suits and business attire hovering in these little rooms, and that's what they do. They're meeting with people, and yes, I'm sure some are constituents who
with money,
who they're trying to help out with this, that, or the other, and there's some people who are really quite honorable and they try to do this, but it seems like the bulk of it is just figuring out who can put some money in your hand.
I don't think it's cynical. I think you're absolutely on point. And with that statement, then, what you said at the beginning of really withdrawing your consent and not entering the system at all becomes even more poignant. What's your take on the Republicans in Congress? When they swept into power in the last election, stating that they were going to get rid of Obamacare, that they were not going to allow any, you know, they're going to be an advocate for the free thought, you know, free market, anything that's supposedly, quote, libertarian, right? Mm-hmm. And they're in there now. And isn't it a Republican that actually put forth this SGR fix?
Well, yes, and it was a bipartisan thing.
Yeah, well.
And mm-hmm. both sides, their little letters that they put out touting it and saying how wonderful it is. And it does make me wonder where that 200 pages of the bill came from with all the various rules and regulations in order to get your money. You don't know who was told that this was a good thing. And, of course, they didn't read it. And most of these folks aren't reading this stuff. And it's really sad because the Republicans came in, of course. Number one, you know they could not repeal Obamacare. Obama would have to sign the law.
Right.
I mean, so that's clear. There's no way they could repeal it, even though in Congress they passed multiple laws bills that said, yes, we'll repeal Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
So the one thing they did do when they came in, they started chipping away at the edges, like putting the health savings account amounts back up to what they were. None of these things have gone through the Senate, and they had done some of these things last session, but Harry Reid was in charge of the Senate, so he never took up the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the Republicans have the Senate, and we'll see whether they actually take up some of these bills to restore some of the so-called freedom to purchase the kind of insurance you want, to make catastrophic insurance available to more people because they put a limit that you had to be 29 years or younger in order to buy it, and some of these various limits that were on Obamacare. But the thing that struck me in going through the health-related laws is that in the end, you still want to be reelected,
mm-hmm.
and presumably you want to do what your constituents want. And this is where the congressperson is caught between two things. You want to repeal Obamacare, and you'd like to change Medicare. However, your constituents have been so married to Medicare that in order to keep them liking you, you've got to do something to, quote-unquote, improve Medicare. So now there are these multiple bills that are being put forth to add more things onto Medicare. Right now, Medicare doesn't pay for hearing aids, you know, routine hearing aids, so they want to add that on there. They want to add full payment for all audiology services, and so they want to add more services onto Medicare. And this is where it's almost an ethical dilemma. On one hand, you know your people are dependent on Medicare, so let's give them more. But once you give them more, then they will be totally dependent on the government.
Well, there's another side to that, too. The more you give them, the less access they're going to have.
As soon as there's more doctors
dropping out left and right, I can bet audiologists are going to follow when they start paying you $10 for a hearing aid. I mean, whatever Medicare gives you, And I don't, you know, people, there seems to be another, this is like predictive programming. On AOL, there's been a couple of articles on how much money doctors make and how they're the top money makers, money-making professions. This is predictive programming to demonize us further so that they have the upper hand on, well, they don't deserve to make this kind of money. We don't make that kind of money. The only people who really do that are academics who are getting a salary. Anybody who's out in the real world paying their own, you know, malpractice, their own overhead, is not pulling in that kind of money as their paycheck. They may make it as a whole, but they don't take it home. They don't tell you that.
No, of course not. Of course not. And they're not going to tell you how many hours worked. In fact, when you read something that's actually in the medical literature where it doesn't have some political bent to it, if you break it down as a by-the-hour payment, it's quite a reasonable sum, and in fact, less than some trades. There is a thing, does a doctor really make less than a plumber? And certainly pediatricians do. And when you look at it by the hour, people don't realize how many hours a week a doctor might work. I mean, there were some weeks when you added it all up, it's like, my goodness, you know, I've done put in 65 hours here, and I don't mean of just sitting on call. I mean in there working, and that's not on an on-call weekend.
That's right. Or you're finished patients at 4 or 5, but you don't get home until 9 because you're doing paperwork. Mm-hmm. That doesn't get added in. Or you're taking calls or returning calls. That doesn't add into your time that you're making money. But it's not
not to mention that you don't charge for it.
No.
And that's another thing. I mean, lawyers can charge for a phone conversation. Doctors don't.
Exactly.
There's no code for talking to a patient. And their husband just died, so you're on the phone with them for an hour unpaid time. And gladly doing it, but
exactly.
That doesn't get calculated in.
Well, it certainly doesn't mean that they can demonize you. That's what they're getting a freebie on, and we're allowing them to do that. And I think as long as doctors play this game, we're going to get the same result. And I'm all for opting out of the system. I did it 7 years ago, and I'm not going back. I just re-upped my opt-out status. Look, how can people reach you if they want to contact you?
Well, excuse me. I have a email that I take all comers on, and that's msingletonmdjd@gmail.com.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. I always learn so much from you, and we just have to just get together and just talk. There's so much stuff that I just want to ask you.
that assumes we don't get too depressed after the conversation.
Well, I hope you'll come back again in the future.
Thank you, and I'll be glad to.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Have a great day. And thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
This is America's Webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.